Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend, three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. Brian Lehrer Show, family meeting about travel. And let's talk now about the most profound travel experience you've ever set out to have, about travel as a quest. Tell us a story of a time your travel rose to the level of a pilgrimage or a quest. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. A few years ago, we had the photographer Annie Leibovitz on the show, who wrote a book called Pilgrimage, and we took calls specifically on the related idea of the pilgrimage. Many of you, it turned out, had gone on one.
I had made a pilgrimage to Granada, Spain, to visit the house of Federico García Lorca.
I have two pilgrimage places, one in honor of the God-sent abolitionist, Reverend John Brown. I visit the former federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry.
We went to Georgia O'Keeffe's house, really viscerally felt like I was in her space. I was inside a photograph.
I visited a small cemetery with 40 graves in it on land that was purchased by some Scots-Irish ancestors of mine.
Some of your pilgrimage stories. We will talk to Cheryl Strayed in a minute, who went on one at a time of crisis in her life and famously wrote about it in her book Wild. But Cheryl Strayed and I want to know about your pilgrimage or your quest. 212-433-WNYC. What was the deepest reason you ever set out to travel? And did you find what you were looking for? 212-433-WNYC. Maybe you've gone on a religious pilgrimage. Have you done the Hajj, the actual Hajj? Have you taken the birthright trip to Israel? I know a couple that travels around the world a bit, a Jewish couple, and they haven't traveled until they've seen a synagogue wherever they go. Gone looking for that ashram or that yogi in the Himalayas? 212-433-WNYC. And did you find what you were looking for? Or maybe you've been on a family pilgrimage. How about some of those family stories that we got in the overture to this show in the opening segment? Have you gone to the town of your immigrant grandparents' birth? Something I want to do and haven't done yet. Tell us a story of your pilgrimage to your roots. And what does the travel have to do with it? Why does the act of going to a different place open us up the way it does? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Have you gone on a pilgrimage to discover something outside of yourself, or more on a pilgrimage to discover something about yourself? Maybe like my friend here at the station, my obsessed friend, it was a pilgrimage to find the most old-fashioned, low-tech, minor league baseball stadiums in America. Maybe it was a pilgrimage or a quest to find out or to find what you didn't even know you were looking for. Tell us your best quest story. What was the deepest reason you ever set out to travel for? And did you find what you were looking for? 212-433-WNYC. And to join us on this journey, we have a very special guest whose account of her own journey has inspired so many readers. Cheryl Strayed walked 1,100 miles over 3 months in 1995 and wrote the memoir Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail. Cheryl, so nice to have you along for this ride. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, thanks so much. It's great to be here.
And as you write in Wild, and as the subtitle suggests, you were at a low point in your life. You were in your 20s. You had recently lost your mother, and your marriage had ended. What made you think an 1,100-mile hike could change that, or were you even conscious that that was a goal?
Oh, absolutely. That was the goal. I had reached a low point in my life. My mom died suddenly of cancer at the age of 45 when I was a senior in college, and she was a senior in college, too, as it turns out. And it really began, just a lot of difficult things in my life. And I was in my early 20s, and that's already a difficult time for many people. They're trying to figure out who they are. And I really, looked up when I was about 26 and said, I can't go on this way. I have to gather myself and become the person I know I'm meant to be. And I needed to do something to sort of shake my life up. But I think, obviously, that's what travel does. When we go out of the familiar and into the wild. And I did that literally, out of the comfort zone and into those places where you can discover who you really are. So I just decided I needed to take a big, incredible journey. And it ended up being walking for 3 months on the Pacific Crest Trail.
So you did it very consciously with that in mind. And, of course, you wrote a whole book to answer this question I'm about to ask you. But did you find essentially what you were looking for since you set out so consciously with the goal you just described? Or did you find something different?
I think that we always find something different. When, you know, we set an intention. We're looking for a particular thing. And any good journey takes us on an adventure we couldn't have expected. I think that I found, in a bigger sense, what I was looking for, but I didn't know the route by which I would get it. My hike ended up being so much more physically difficult than I imagined it would be. You know, before I set out, I had this kind of Hollywood movie reel in my mind of, you know, sitting there every evening watching the sunset and weeping over its beauty and feeling connected to the universe. And instead what I got, you know, I got that, but I also got a lot of, real trials, physical trials, pain, deep solitude. I went the first 8 days of my hike without even seeing another human being. And out of those challenges, things arose, and I really learned all of those things that I needed to learn in order to do that thing I set out to do.
And I wonder if Kira in Brooklyn is especially identifying with this, considering what I think she's going to talk about. Kira, you're on WNYC. Thanks so much for calling.
Hi there, Brian. Can you hear me?
I can hear you great.
Great. Well, my quest involved the sudden death of my sister. She actually died while attending the Burning Man Festival out in Nevada, and it was one of those, very unexpected things. It took a year because Burning Man only happens once a year, but by the time the next year came around, I kind of dropped everything in New York, quit my job, left my apartment, left everything I had going here, and kind of made my pilgrimage to Burning Man in my sister's memory.
I'm so sorry you lost your sister.
Thanks.
And so am I.
What was that like to go back and be in the place of her death?
Well, I'd never been there before. So I kind of knew a little bit about what to expect. It's all about community, and a lot of people are going there in a spiritual way. They actually build a temple at Burning Man, and I was able to make a shrine for her there and actually had her ashes there. They burn the whole thing at the end. So actually part of her ashes kind of will always be a part of that part of the desert. So it was really cathartic for me to go back and feel like I could kind of be where she'd spent her last week.
Kira, thanks so much. It's hard to get more profound than that right off the bat. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. I'm sure it's hard to talk about, too. Cheryl, did you ask her what it was like because you were wondering whether it would be more cathartic or more re-traumatizing?
Yeah, I was just curious. I do think there was a caller earlier in the show who suggested going back to childhood places to relive memories. And I think that
in a lighter, in a lighter vein.
Yes, much lighter vein. But I mean, I think that in some ways, you know, even though Kira had never been to Burning Man, she was, you know, obviously visiting a place that had, you know, has a great importance in her life and her family's life. And, you know, I do think I think catharsis and trauma can be really close together. I mean, part of catharsis is reaching into the dark places and you know, being there and being witness to the saddest things in our lives. I don't think that that's to be avoided. I think that's the only way to get to catharsis.
Jessica in Jersey City, tell us about your quest.
Well, my quest was stemmed from childhood. I was raised, as a lot of us were, on Little House on the Prairie, both the books and TV. And I was between jobs in May of 2004 during the cicada invasion, if you recall that. And I decided, I had 6 days between jobs. I decided to take my Mini Cooper and drive to Mansfield, Missouri, where Mrs. Wilder wrote the books, and drive back. So I spent 2 days each way driving and a day and a half in Mansfield, Missouri. And it was it was very emotional. I mean, it brought back a lot of memories of my childhood, and it was just a very soul-stirring, deep experience.
Were other people doing something similar?
There were a lot of school groups, but I noticed a couple of, you know, approaching middle-aged single women looking a little lost, and upon connecting with two of the three of them, they all were doing the same thing. We all felt a little embarrassed until we realized how deep a connection we'd all had to these books as children, and we felt vindicated.
That's an awesome story. Thank you very much. Cheryl Strayed.
I especially love to hear that because I'm a writer. I love it that you know that your hero is a writer.
Where should people go in 50 years to remember you and make that connection with your books?
Well, you know, that's been one of the most amazing things to come out of Wild is we don't have to wait 50 years. There are people right now as we speak hiking the Pacific Crest Trail and other trails around the world because they
right.
were inspired by
right.
Wild.
Right, absolutely. And I wonder if these words mean anything or mean anything different. If you were on a quest and that last caller was on a pilgrimage, you know, that pilgrimage to the Wilder House, but you were on a quest, which was to go figure something out and find something new and break new ground. Do you see a meaning? You're a writer. As a writer, do you see a different nuance, you know, a nuanced difference between those words that has meaning?
I do. I think that there are some, you know, some striking similarities. You are ultimately, I think, seeking solace and personal growth on both those kinds of journeys. But one, you know, the quest is that you're trying to answer the questions. I mean, there's that quest means question, and you're really trying to find the answer to something. In my own case in Wild, it really came down to how can I live without my mother? I had lost, when she died, the essential person in my life. How can I live without her? And I found the answer to that question. I think a pilgrimage is to revisit something you already know and see what more you know about it. To honor, in some ways, the essence of who you are. And so they're linked, but slightly different intentions.
I think Jean in St. Louis went on a quest. Hi, Jean. You're on WNYC. Hello from New York.
Thank you so much. Great to be here. And I can really relate to what Cheryl's saying about being on a pilgrimage and trying to find that thing inside you. And in 2011, in fact, it's 3 years ago this week, I walked off a corporate job, a middle-aged, divorced mother of four who'd finished raising kids. And mine was also, unfortunately, motivated by the death of my brother. And I'd lost two brothers inside a few short years. And I'd always intended to go back and do this road trip with them and to revisit the places where I'd lived. I was a journalist. I'd lived around the country. And I got to a point, Brian, where I just said, I cannot do this life another day. And I quit my job. I called my kids all across the country and said, I'm bugging out. I took my dog, and we traveled 8,600 miles around the country to revisit every place and every person I'd known and loved in my life.
Wow.
And there was another mystery. There had been some very, frankly, everybody has heartache, and there had been some very arduous times that my children and I had gone through some really difficult things. But I had a half-brother from my biological father whom I had never seen and didn't know where he was. And when my brother died in Albuquerque and I had missed the opportunity to go back and to spend more time with him, because, you know, we're distracted. We're distracted by jobs and mortgages and obligations. And I figured out that, you know, living with regret was worse than living with fear. And I thought, screw it, what do I have to lose? I've worked all my life to try to keep a roof over my head, but time's running out. And so I did this trip. I went from St. Louis in a big circle around the country. And I tell you what, I found my brother in Northern California and had never laid eyes on him. And it, the entire trip, frankly, changed my life.
Living with regret is worse than living with fear.
And you learn that, you know, the hard way with best intentions. Like, I wish I'd spent more time with them. I wish that I had stopped what I was doing and gone and done this when I thought about it. And, you know, I think the older we get and the more tied we get to, you know, our responsibilities and our obligations, it can be very paralyzing. And my dog, in fact, was the inspiration. I had this epiphany moment out in my front lawn when she wouldn't go after a cat because of her invisible collar or the electrical fence collar around her neck.
Right.
And she wants to go, you know, chase this cat, and she stops short. And I'm sitting there on my front porch the day that my brother passed away, and I thought, the batteries in her collar are dead. She could go after that thing that she wants, but she's afraid. And that was the day that I said, I don't care. I'm leaving. And in fact, I wrote a book about the trip, and I did a Kickstarter campaign. And I was 56 years old, so I'm not the typical Kickstarter demo. Yeah.
So this is such an amazing story on so many levels. And I want to ask about one little piece of it. Because so here are all these conditions of your life that you've described. But the thing you went to do was to try to see everybody you've ever known in your life and every place you've ever visited in the past, if I heard you right.
Yeah.
Why that? Why were you looking for everybody you've ever known? Why was that the trip?
Because I felt like it was the thing that I longed for. I longed to go to North Carolina and Texas, New Mexico, California. I'd lived in all these places. And I wanted to find cousins I hadn't seen in 40 years to tell them that I loved them. And I wrote about this in the book, that as much as people want to go on these journeys, and I get it absolutely down to my DNA, but the folks that you go see, it makes a difference to them. If you go back and you visit them and you say, you matter to me. And I just think it's so important for us to seize those opportunities to go back and visit those folks and say, you made a difference in my life.
Incredible. Cheryl, you want to talk to your fellow memoirist at all?
Well, I just would love to read your book. But I also feel, you know, I relate to so much of what you're saying. I so much of my ability to go on that hike when I did had to do with what you just said. You know, I decided not to let fear rule me.
Right.
So often
right.
people say,
that.
How could you go out there by yourself? You know, I was alone in the wilderness, you know, for 94 days, and I was really alone. I mean, this was very remote wilderness. And they, you know, people ask, weren't you afraid? And yes, I sometimes was afraid, but mostly what I said to myself is, I am not afraid. I decided that fear would not be my ruler. And I think, of course, you know, we always have to, you know, take precautions and all of those things. I'm not talking about, you know, just throwing yourselves into the world. I'm saying, you know, so many of us don't do the things we really want to do because we decide to let fear be our ruler. And I just wasn't willing to do that. It sounds like you weren't either.
Jean, awesome. Thank you so much. You've added so much.
Sure. My book is Off the Leash.
Off the Leash.
Off the Leash,
Jean
okay.
Ellen Watley. And Cheryl, you're an inspiration, and I get where you're coming from. And I you know, bless you for all your good work. And I appreciate the opportunity
Thank
to be
you.
On the show.
And Jean, what was your last name? I think I stepped on it.
That's all right. So Jean Ellen Watley, and my book is Off the Leash, How My Dog Inspired Me to Quit My Job, Pet My Car, and Take a Road Trip Across America to Reclaim My Life.
Thank you, and good luck.
Thanks.
Elizabeth in Washington Heights, what was your quest?
Hi. You have the most incredible callers. That last call was unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
So I had always been very proud of the fact that I had been to all 62 of New York State's counties. And then one night in a fit of internet-induced insomnia, I realized, much to my mortification, I had only been to 59 of them. So I had been lying, in essence, saying that I'd been all over the state. So I made it my business in the following year to go to these other three counties. So the last, they were Allegheny, Yates, and Lewis. The last county that I went to was Lewis County, which is in the middle of the state, as I think you know. It's in the middle of the Adirondacks. There's no there. You have to be going there because that's where you're going. You wouldn't be driving through. And when I got there at, I don't know, it was about midnight, I walked into the hotel and said to the lady, is this Lewis County? And she said, yes. And I was like, great. And she looked at me like I had four noses. That who would be that excited to be in this nothing place in the town? So I explained it to her, and she thought that was pretty cool.
How had you wound up going to 59 of the 62 counties before you even thought about it in the first place?
I grew up on Long Island. I take road trips with my kids. So when they were little, we did a number of New York State road trips that included going all the way up to Plattsburgh and then driving around the hump of Lake Ontario and down to Syracuse for the state fair and over to Niagara Falls. I went to college in Buffalo. I had lots of friends in the Southern Tier. My daughter went to college in Binghamton. I've been to the Catskills and the Adirondacks. So I've crisscrossed the state. It's a big state.
Oh, yeah.
But so the next day, I really wanted to honor this sort of, well, quest, I guess, more than pilgrimage, of going to all around the state. So I went to the Historical Museum of Lewis County, which, you know, it's only open 3 days a week, and fortunately the day that I was there was one of them. And when I walked in, I explained to the guy, you know, here was my quest, so this is my last county, what have you got? This guy knew, like, everything about Lewis County and took me on an intimate tour of every weird and interesting artifact of Lewis County.
Tell me one thing before I go. Tell me one thing about Lewis County, or describe one artifact, can you?
Yes. I don't remember his name, but the reason why we have the Forever Wild Adirondacks, which is the largest sort of not national park, it's a state park, is because the Secretary of Interior at the time under, I'm not going to make it up, I don't remember which president, at the turn of the in the 19th century, was from the Adirondacks and wanted to preserve that. So that's the sort of national legacy, and he was a son of Lewis County.
There you go. Great story. Elizabeth, all 62 counties in New York State. John in Queens, can you top that?
Well, a little bit. I've been to all 3,142 counties in the United States.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
40 years ago, just after I got out of graduate school, a friend and I took an 8,000-mile trip in a Volkswagen. And when I passed into my 49th state, you know, I got this crazy idea. Well, I've been to 49 states. 50 will be easy. And then I took a look at a map of the United States with all the counties. And I said, you know, that's a quest. And so last September, I visited my two last counties up in the Aleutians. I went to Aleutians West census area, and I went to Aleutians East Borough. And it has been amazing. Actually, you and I have something in common, Brian, because in 1990 I called you and talked to you about the fact that you and I stayed at the same hotel in Denali National Park.
Oh, gosh, I remember that.
And
in fact, I remember
then,
because
you
the show, I'll tell you.
A little bit more traveling.
Wow, that's an incredible story. John, I'll just tell the listeners that the show was just 1 year old at that time. And that was like my first little taste of fame in a way, that it was that somebody was actually listening, you know, and that it was getting out beyond the four corners of, you know, the most listened to blocks for public radio in New York, because that was really my first vacation in the history of doing the show. And my wife and I went to Alaska, and we thought we were getting as far away as we could possibly get, finding the dirt roads and all of that. And the clerk, I don't think we met, but the clerk at the hotel said, oh, you're Brian Lehrer from the radio. A guy here saw your name in the guest book, and he's a listener. And I was like,
that was me.
Holy moly, at Denali.
Mm-hmm.
So, then you've gone. So, John, after visiting how many counties in America?
3,142. It fluctuates slightly. Things change again and now and again.
So is it like notches on the wall, and I did it, and I did it, and I did it, and
no,
I can check this one off, or is it deeper?
The most important thing about it was the travel. And in fact, I'm not trying to promote anything. I just wrote a 13-page essay about it, but I'm trying to shop around to magazines and stuff. And I call it a book of 3,142 pages. I mean, I went to the leper colony in Molokai, which is a separate county, and I had to hike down the 1,600-foot cliff path to get there.
Wow.
Of course, I was in Unalaska, which is also called Dutch Harbor, which was incredible. And then I went to a place called Cold Bay. That was my absolute last county. Turned out to be the bleakest place I've been. But I'm so glad to have done all those things. I've listened to old men in 1,000 different restaurants for breakfast, because that's where old men go in the morning. Talking about local politics, local life in Iowa and in Minnesota and in Georgia and all over. I've had amazing epiphanies in places, and it's been just the most wonderful thing to do. In the meantime, I've also been to all seven continents. I have hiked the Inca Trail. I have been to the Serengeti Plains. I have been in all three of the big pyramids at Giza. I've been very lucky. I love to travel. I was an officer in the Navy in the 60s, and I've been around the world twice and things like that. So been lucky.
I thought I was good for sleeping in 45 states. Now I feel like a pipsqueak. John, thank you very much. That is awesome. And Cheryl Strayed, we're running out of time, but I know that you are going to read something for us from your book. This is a passage about the emotional journey you were on that Wild was based on, and I think you're talking about the halfway point of your trip when you had just passed a deer who reacted to you calmly. Do you want to set this up
right.
anymore?
Sure. Well, yeah, it is the midpoint of the journey, and I think the previous caller just used that word epiphany. And, you know, I think most journeys, what we find is we have epiphanies along the way. And so this was a moment where I guess I felt an opening. I felt that I was getting what I went out there to get. I gazed out over the darkening land. There were so many amazing things in this world. They opened up inside of me like a river. I laughed with the joy of it, and the next minute I was crying my first tears on the PCT. I cried and I cried and I cried. I wasn't crying because I was happy. I wasn't crying because I was sad. I wasn't crying because of my mother or my father or Paul. I was crying because I was full. California streamed behind me like a long silk veil. I didn't feel like a big fat idiot anymore, and I didn't feel like an Amazonian queen. I felt fierce and humble and gathered up inside, like I was safe in this world, too. And so really that was just a moment where, you know, I was out there. I'd been hiking about 50 days by that point. So many hard things had happened to me. And I'd never cried until there was this moment of beauty, of fullness. I could see that I was getting what I'd come for, which is really extraordinary.
So beautiful. And Cheryl Strayed, thanks so much for riding along and kind of being the centerpiece of this part of our family meeting on travel. People's amazing story. And weren't the callers amazing?
They were. I loved listening to all of their stories. I wish we were all sitting around the table. We could talk more. I wanted to ask them all questions.
We'll have to do this for, you know, a weekend sometime.
Yeah.
With 100,000 other people.
Or you could all go hiking with me. We could talk a lot in the woods.
I like it. Cheryl Strayed, author of Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail. Thanks.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now we turn to the tricky landscape of slurs, soccer, and the Spanish language in the World Cup. Maybe you've been hearing about the controversy surrounding a gay slur that some fans have been chanting in Spanish during some of the games. We'll talk about that and why FIFA says it's kind of okay. Or maybe you were watching one of the games on Univision and heard Spanish language commentators identify some of the players by the color of their skin. Maybe that made you cringe, as it did my next guest. And we'll talk about that. Or maybe as you've been following the saga of Uruguay's Luis Suarez, the guy who's been suspending for biting an Italian player, you've been reminded of that time that he was also suspended for allegedly telling another player in Spanish that he was kicked because he's black, and that linguistic experts were called in to determine if that was an insult or not. So we'll discuss that now, too. Felix Sanchez is chairman and co-founder of the National Hispanic Foundation for the Arts. Felix, welcome to WNYC. Happy USA versus Belgium Day.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to the game later today.
Let's start with your story and an issue with the Univision commentary that you flagged. This started when you were watching Costa Rica face off against Uruguay. What happened?
Essentially, the sportscasters had been using the last name of the players to talk about, do their color commentary. But when it came to an Afro-Latino player, they then referred to that player as Moreno. And they also went further and described his hair, which was neatly pulled back in dreads, as greña. Now, again, the subtlety, the issue is that it was the equivalent of saying the black guy with dreads, you know, and referring to him in that manner, as opposed to giving him the full respect of using his last name and talking about his play rather than describing him in physical characteristics.
So you posted your concerns to your Facebook page, and the conversation really took off. It started a thread on Reddit, another one on the Hispanic blog, Latino Rebels, and on, and the comments are really all over the map. I'm going to read a few for our listeners so they get a sense of how people are reacting to this. Quote, "I've been nicknamed Morenita, and it's affectionate, not insulting, at least not in Spanish. I guess if someone were to nickname me Brown in English, that would be rude. While I don't find these terms offensive," this person writes, "I guess I can understand that they are when they're heard with an English ear. Biculturalism is tricky." You want to react to that one, that sort of defense of it in the cultural context of Spanish?
Yes. I think that what happens is people get confused about the appropriateness of the use of these terms. It's one thing if in culture someone that you feel can say these words to you, like a parent or a grandparent, then that's one thing. But when it's a professional individual who is calling a World Cup game begins to use these descriptors, it clearly falls outside of the range of acceptable.
Listeners, 212-433-WNYC. If you're bilingual, Spanish and English speakers, what do you think about this question about race and language? Does it translate? Have you been watching the games on Univision and heard some of this commentary yourself? What did you think? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And how else would you compare the calling of the games in English from that in Spanish if you've been watching on both Univision and ESPN? 212-433-9692. To that last commenter's point, are there words or terms of endearment that you use in Spanish but you wouldn't use the equivalent in English? 212-433-9692 for Felix Sanchez, chairman and co-founder of the National Hispanic Foundation for the Arts. Another of the comments, quote, "The only Latinos complaining about this are Americanized Latinos who are so sensitive to everything. Go and watch ESPN. Spanish commentators have been doing the best commentating for many decades." So how about that? That this is U.S. sensitivities. Language aside, this is politically U.S. And in Latin American countries, people just aren't so sensitive about these same sorts of references.
Well, I think the fundamental issue is Univision is a U.S. broadcaster. The fact that they are broadcasting in Spanish does not hold them to a lesser standard. In fact, it holds them to an equal standard.
Oh, that's a really important point that people may not realize. Univision, though it's in Spanish, is not broadcasting to Mexico, to Costa Rica, to Chile, et cetera, et cetera. That's a U.S. Spanish language network.
That's exactly correct. And there's where, what's happening here is you can see it in the ratings. For example, Univision has been killing ESPN in the ratings. And who is that additional viewer that has come to the table to create that kind of success? I believe that from anecdotal conversations and on Facebook and on threads that have happened, is that individuals who are bilingual or even English language leaning Latinos want a more authentic experience and therefore tune in to Univision's color commentary over ESPN. And that is creating this huge wave of viewership and record-breaking audience viewers that have come to the table, and they've come to the World Cup through Univision as opposed to through ESPN. But when you are listening to the commentators, you do start to see that there's a disparity in the way that, as an American, you would expect the commentary to go. Now, having said that, Univision did reach out to me immediately after these comments were posted, and since those early games, there has not been a single comment made in that direction.
So they stopped. In response to your piece, they stopped.
They stopped, and I think that it was really, we helped nip it in the bud, because as you know, there have been other examples, not just from Univision, but There have been, you know, certainly the Dutch, after they won over Mexico, the commentary that KLM, the airline, the Royal Dutch airline, made on Twitter about using a mustachioed Mexican with a sombrero and a serape and saying, you know, Mexico, go home. You know, it was a very insulting way of winning, and they certainly pulled that tweet. But they're not alone. It's not just Latin America who hasn't made the social progress that I think we in America like to think we've made. But we've also seen this through European players and the German fans and being dressed up in blackface and, you know, all the other kinds of things that, you know, have caused concern.
Anna in Bayside, you're on WNYC. Hi, Anna.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
I was just telling the screener, I think your guest is oversensitive. I think he's wrong. I think you have to see it in the context of who the audience is. You know, I'm just going to say that maybe these announcers are not even American. I don't get the impression that they broadcast on regularly for an American-based audience, but their own Colombians, Mexicans. And you have to see it for what it is. I mean, it's part of who we are. Yeah, you know, I have aunts that I call as negra, you know, not prieta because that's insulting, but negra. There's nothing wrong with it. It's a term of endearment. If you're taking it out of context or you're becoming hypersensitive, give me a break. You know, that's why I don't watch ESPN. It's boring. There's no personality to them. You know, the world is not that sterile, and I don't think they meant any offense by that.
Felix, talk to Anna.
Sure. I mean, this is a common misunderstanding that we don't realize that even though the broadcast is coming in Spanish, it is from a U.S. broadcaster, and a U.S. broadcaster must follow the standards laid out by the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC. And under that kind of standard, these kinds of comments are really inappropriate. And we're trying to kind of justify them and sort of feel that they're culturally acceptable, but not from a professional sportscaster who is calling a game for a U.S. audience, regardless of the fact that the language is Spanish and not English.
But the audience that they're broadcasting to lives in the U.S., but it's not culturally. Some of them, American, I hate to tell you, but a lot of my aunts and uncles who are watching this were not brought up here. And, you know, there's a difference between calling someone a moreno and calling them other words that we can find. It's not like moreno is equivalent of the N-word.
Well,
it's a term of endearment. I mean, you're trying to change the way that sometimes we refer to our loved ones, or even they refer to them, you know, some of our loved ones refer to themselves. You're putting political correctness out there, and I just don't think it warrants it. I don't think it merits it. It's not like they were insulting. You know, they also refer to others that are super, you know, white. Los blanquitos. I mean, what are you going to say? That's also bad?
Well, they didn't say that. That's the point, is that you would not have heard on ESPN or on any other sports commentary sportscasters calling someone by the color of their skin. And whether you find that, whether you understand that initially, it's an important standard that we demand from Spanish language broadcasters. Just like when Howard Cosell, for example, as a sportscaster, referred to a black player as a monkey, and he was immediately fired for those comments. So when individuals make comments, whether in English or in Spanish, on the air, there are broadcast standards. And when those standards and sensibilities are violated, then there are repercussions. Now, the good news here was that Univision immediately understood this because they value their audience, but they also wanted to make sure that they were not offending American sensibilities, because that is their audience. Whether that individual was born here or not, that is not the issue.
Anna,
thank you. Audience is.
Thank you for your call. Our next caller, I think, is going to be more friendly to your argument here. Ed in Jamaica, Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ed.
Yeah, good afternoon. How you doing?
All right.
Basically, I must agree with you, sir. I am of Latino and African-American descent, and Moreno is not a term of endearment. It depends on who you're talking to and the context is used, and it has been used, especially on the island of Haiti, as an insult, and it's pejorative. And the man is a professional sports announcer. You know the man's name. You get the roster. You can use your, you can use the man, you can use everybody else's name. Why must you refer to this man as a color and a hairstyle? I found it totally offensive, to be totally honest with you. And it's the elephant in the room that nobody, especially in Latin American countries, wants to discuss. There is a lot of racism. If you look at Univision's broadcast lineup, how many black faces do you see on there? Or how many faces of African American of African Latino descent do you see on any Spanish language station in America or in the countries of the prospective origin? It was insulting, and I applaud you and I thank you for pulling their coat on it. But there's a lot more that people don't discuss because people think that racism and ethnic biases are big in America because of the historical content. But it is also big in European and Latin American countries.
And thank you, Felix.
You know, you're absolutely right, and I think that you can't sense the level of insult unless you are an Afro-Latino. If you are an Afro-Latino, you know immediately that the word Moreno is used by, in some countries, especially in Central America, to mean black. And so when they're referring to an Afro-Latino player and they use the word Moreno, they are basically saying the black guy. And that is not the way a professional sportscaster calls a game. And that's the point.
And I want to touch on one other thing before you go, as we're running out of time. If listeners tuned into the Mexico-Netherlands game on Saturday, they heard a disclaimer on Univision about offensive language against gays. But that's not about the commentators. That's about the fans. Mexico and Brazil fans have been chanting a slur that translates roughly to male prostitute or gay prostitute. FIFA investigated this chant used by Mexican fans during a game against Cameroon and decided that it was, quote, not considered insulting in the specific context. How is that not a slur?
You know, I think that they've made a mistake there. And I think that we were heading toward a place of neutrality where we're not using slurs, acceptable slurs, because that's what they've essentially said. And in this instance, I really applaud what Univision did because they put a disclaimer and said that they do not endorse these kinds of words or slurs by fans. And that, you know, that is a huge step in the right direction.
Well, maybe somewhere in the Netherlands there's a slur for Flemish people. I don't know it, and hopefully we won't hear one this afternoon at 4 o'clock when half of America will stop what they're doing and turn on their television sets. But we will have to leave it there, whether you hear it in Spanish on Univision or in English on ESPN. Enjoy the game. Felix Sanchez is chairman and co-founder of the National Hispanic Foundation for the Arts. And thank you for talking about the issue of the language that is sometimes used in these broadcasts. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And screening today and tomorrow at the IFC Cinema in the Village, The Pleasures of Being Out of Step, a documentary about the legendary Village Voice columnist, jazz writer, and civil libertarian, Nat Hentoff, made by WNYC's own Metro editor, David Lewis. It includes rarely seen archival footage like this. Lenny Bruce in the 1950s, talking about the Young Weekly newspaper. Then we'll hear Hentoff from the film, looking back on going from being a jazz critic to a general columnist, Lenny Bruce's voice first.
This is a newspaper I'm reading. It's brilliant. It's called The Village Voice. And actually, this is a brilliant newspaper. It's published in The Village, and it has a very brilliant editorial staff, plus some very erudite contributors. See, we've got Nat Hentoff, who subject is jazz. He knows about it, and he writes in sometimes a satirical manner.
The Voice was very small then. It covered most things below 14th Street. But the freelance work was hard to get. because most of the editors in town saw me only as a jazz person. So I said, I'll do it, but I don't have to write about jazz if I don't want to. They agreed to that. There was no money. Voice was very poor at the time. And I found out that having a byline can quickly make you an authority, at least to people who are not very intelligent about authorities. So I began to write about education, civil rights, civil liberties.
And that excerpt from the film, The Pleasures of Being Out of Step, about Nat Hentoff, filmmaker and WNYC Metro editor David Lewis, joins us now. Hi, David.
Good morning, Brian.
And a spoiler alert for this segment. Hentoff is still alive and kicking at age 89, I think, and we may have an unnamed special guest join us by phone in a few minutes. But why did you make a documentary about Nat Hentoff?
Well, he was very influential to me as I was growing up. I went to high school in Westchester during the 70s, that awful period in American politics and public life. And, of course, my friends and I bought The Voice every week for the music listings. But Hentoff was always there, and he was always this guy who just sort of stood out against that background. And when someone suggested that I take a look at doing the documentary, and I discovered more and more about his second career or his first career as a jazz critic and how influential and important he was in that field, I wanted to know sort of what the connection was between the two aspects of his career. And when I discovered that, that's when I decided I had a film.
And I watched the film over the weekend. Great fun and thought-provoking and some jaw-dropping archival footage like Lenny Bruce there. Who, by the way, was smoking a cigarette in that clip to look cool as he did that stand-up routine.
He was a pretty cool guy at that time. There's a little backstory. I'm smiling at hearing that clip because I discovered it sitting one weekend doing research in the Museum of Television and Radio. And, you know, I was just calling up all these Lenny Bruce stuff, and that clip came up, and it was just one of those great moments of discovery you have as a filmmaker. And I was like, well, I know that's going in the film.
And here's another example, a young William F. Buckley Jr. in the 1960s interviewing, if we can call this interviewing, Nat Hentoff about Malcolm X.
Nat Hentoff is a writer and possibly the leading writer on American jazz. He is especially interested in the Negro question. We must also, he writes, have black power to overcome white power.
Most advocates of black power believe that the civil rights movement, as exemplified, let's say, by the kind of spirit that We Shall Overcome had, which was a quite noble period, I think, though short, is at an end. And that now it's a post-civil rights period which has to deal with very radical in the terms of getting to the root problems of housing and education and jobs and the like, and singing songs won't break those walls down.
Are you saying something that has been sort of hinted at, that under the circumstances we can actually learn something from the separatist rhetoric of Elijah Muhammad by urging sort of an autarkic, endogamous enthusiasm, economic and cultural?
That was the case for years and still is in large part among Jews in this country. It was called in my day Yiddishkeit, and this kind of in-group feeling did help. I think it also does some harm as well, too, because when you do go out into the wide world, you find out that these equations don't really work out that way.
Unfortunately, some people love you.
Young Nat Hentoff with young William F. Buckley, Jr., autarkic and endogamous. Who is that person?
So much fun to hear that. And I want to tell your listeners that if you go see the film, when Buckley starts talking about overcoming white power, he looks directly in the camera, and you can tell that he is, in fact, the embodiment of white power.
David Lewis's film about Hentoff showing at the IFC in the Village today and tomorrow. I just want to go right on to the next clip that I pulled, maybe my favorite from the film. And listeners, here's a roadmap to the different voices that we're about to hear in this clip. And it's exactly about what David Lewis was talking about before, that intersection between jazz and democracy that was Hentoff. Hentoff talks about the most important record he ever made as a record producer, Max Roach's Freedom Now Suite, the jazz album from the civil rights era. We'll hear Abby Lincoln singing on this record, the poet who just recently died, Amiri Baraka, talking about it back in the day. But it begins with Hentoff in the studio where the Freedom Now Suite was made.
Paris decided that they wanted her out of her misery, and they'd been told by experts that if she lived, she'd never recognize them. She'd be.
Sorry, that's our mistake. That's a different clip that we'll get to in a little while. Let's see if we have this one. Okay. Hantoff in the recording studio on Max Roach's Freedom Now suite.
Do you remember this?
That's probably the most important thing we ever did here. A few months after it was released, it was banned in South Africa, which pleased the musicians no end. And Abby Lincoln was a supper club singer, very beautiful, sang the usual supper club songs, and that was her first breakthrough, this recording.
Chopping cotton, don't be slow. Better finish out your rope. Keep a moving with that plow. Driver man will show you how.
I've never forgotten that session. It was electric. Coleman Hawkins was there. You know, he invented the jazz tenor saxophone. He was one of the people, and he got involved in the whole spirit of it.
That record not only was important then, it will be important. That was an attempt of Hintoff to actually put the music in a contemporary perspective altogether. You know, he had great respect for Max Roach, and Max had great respect for Nat, which was interesting, knowing Max. because Max actually would make a list of people he didn't like.
He was the guy who, the first musician who said this to me, he said, you know, what we do is like the Constitution. It's a bunch of individuals with individual voices really listening to each other and coming out with a whole. And that's what the Bill of Rights is all about. Now, that was Max Roach. He wasn't a PhD in constitutional law, but he got the idea.
That excerpt from the film, The Pleasures of Being Out of Step, about Nat Hentoff, filmmaker and WNYC Metro editor David Lewis with us. And would you say that what Hentoff said there about Max Roach is true of Hentoff, too, the sort of intersection where jazz and democracy meet?
I think that is really what the film is about. That's at the core of who he is and what his role has been in public life.
And one more clip, then, before a certain special guest will join this conversation. Nat Hentoff explaining why he, a Village Voice progressive icon of the 1960s, became a right-to-lifer on abortion, having to do with a case of a baby known as Jane Doe in the courts with spina bifida.
Parents decided that they wanted her out of her misery, and they'd been told by experts that if she lived, she'd never recognize them. She'd be in perpetual pain. And what struck me was that everybody agreed with that, all the newspapers. At the same time, I heard the woman who was then the Reproductive Rights Unit chairman for the American Civil Liberties Union talking about the case and saying essentially, of course the parents had a right. That was their child. It wasn't going to be a full person. So I started researching fetal surgery, and read the medical books, and it was then a beginning science where surgeons who were specialists would go into the womb. If the fetus had problems, they would repair it. Then the next day, that fetus, who was beginning to seem to be a human being to me, could be killed by abortion. I became a pro-lifer.
Nat Hentoff talking in the documentary about the pleasures of being out of step, about this fetus that was in the news with spina bifida. And I guess he was never more out of step with his usual cohort than on that, would you say?
Yeah, definitely I would say that. Probably his most famous dissent. What I wanted to do was show how he got to that position. I really tried. We do get into a little bit of the back and forth of the abortion debate, but I didn't want to relitigate that debate. You know, so many films have been made just about that debate. What I wanted to show was how this man got to that position.
I will say that my wife once wrote a letter to the editor of The Voice after Hentoff wrote that progressives should think of a fetus as a baby seal in utero, because progressives wanted to save the baby seals from being killed, but not the baby humans, as he saw it. So she wrote back, and it was her one printed letter to the editor, that Hentoff should write about a huge mammal in some part of the male anatomy. So there. But that was the kind of outrage that he was sparking.
And I'm sure that there were many other letters.
And also with us now, on the phone from his home, is Nat Hentoff, who has been on this program many times over the years. Hi, Nat. Can you hear me?
I certainly can, and I'm also glad David Lewis is here, because when he first called me, I couldn't believe it. I'm not a household word, but my goodness, he did all the interviewing on the show, and he somehow intersected all the various parts of my life. It's not often that somebody gets to see and hear his obituary while he's still here.
If it is an obituary. I once told you about my wife's letter when you were here for a segment, and you remembered it. Are you still a right-to-lifer?
Oh, of course. I'm an atheist pro-lifer, which means that both sides have reason to find me not what I should be. But I'm used to that.
Was that the most intense alienation, Nat, that you felt from your usual political allies in taking an independent stand? Because women in this film, like Karen Durbin, former voice editor, and, your own wife, think this was not a rational political position that you took, but a reaction to something personal, like an aborted child in your own life. Have you had ambivalence about that?
No, the thing is that all the positions I take that change come from being a reporter. I've been a reporter since I was a teenager in Boston, and I come into stories, like I think a lot of other people do, with sort of presets. You know, I know pretty much what's going on, then I find out that I don't. And once I validate the facts, I change what I write. And this gets me into trouble all the time. But that's part of being a reporter.
And in this film, you call yourself not a liberal, but a small L libertarian.
Well, I'll tell you, I finally found a home. After being fired by The Voice after more than 50 years, I am now on the staff of the Cato Institute in Washington, which is a libertarian institute. And while I'm not, as usual, fully in agree with everything there, they are very much for free speech, that's for sure. And so they circulate my columns and all that. And the point is, once you start writing, you find out, and I do this all the time, almost every day or every week, I find out more than I thought I knew when I wrote on a subject. So that's part of the, let's say, the stimulation of being a columnist.
And listeners, we have a few minutes for phone calls. If you want to talk to Nat Hentoff or David Lewis, filmmaker of The Pleasures of Being Out of Step, about Nat's life and work, showing today and tomorrow at the IFC in the Village, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Nat, just to follow up on what you just said, the Cato Institute, really, with the economy politics that they have, you know, like Rand Paul and Ayn Rand and other people not named Rand.
You mentioned Rand Paul, and that's how I've lost a lot of friends lately. If he is nominated, and he's certainly running for president now, of all the possible candidates I know of now, and if he is nominated, I will support him because we don't agree with him on everything. He is the one candidate who is continually involved in getting people to understand the Constitution. When he did that 13-hour speech, he started out by talking about the 9th and 10th Amendment. How many Americans know about that? And I talked to him recently and suggested to him, one of my passions now is we have students around the country, public school students, without any mandated courses in the history of the United States, and certainly none in the dramatic history of what it's taken to keep the Constitution intact. And now we have a president who, more than any other one, has done more to violate the separation of powers. So here is a candidate for the presidency who starts telling people, hey, the 9th and 10th Amendment says you have the power that Congress and the executive branch do not have in certain areas.
You're not that's not canceled out for you by the regressive economics of the libertarians, the extreme free marketism?
I am imperfect. I don't agree with all of that. And that's why I'm not concerned with being totally involved in any movement or anything, but if I'm comfortable with what for me is the most important principle of an organization, and that's how I feel about Cato, I'm very much at home there. Some of them may not think I should be at home there, but I'm used to that.
I think Nat, David wants to say something to you. David?
Good morning, Nat.
Good morning.
Nat, I wanted to know, regarding the Cato Institute, what your feelings are about the Koch brothers and their involvement with the Cato Institute and their role in American politics.
Well, the Koch brothers, of course, they have every right to try to do everything they can, and they have billions of dollars to do that. And they were among the founders, in a way, of the Cato Institute. But then, in recent years, they wanted to take it over, and they came pretty close. They had, I think, one or two people on the main committee, and when it looked as if they might do that, a number of us at Cato were going to leave because the Koch brothers are not that much interested in free speech or anything. They want to run things, and they have the money to try to do it. And if they had taken over Cato, the whole principle of free speech there, I think, would have been sadly weakened.
Andreas in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Hello, David Lewis. This is Andres Enriquez, Hamilton College, class of 82.
Good morning.
Good morning. Nat, I wanted to know, thank you so much for being on the show, and I've read so many of your columns. When I was a youngster, you must have an amazing record collection, and I'm wondering what you might do with that record collection once you pass on, and might it end up in the Smithsonian or elsewhere?
Don't bury him before his time.
I'm just wondering. You must have an amazing collection. If anyone wants to donate it to me, I'd be more than happy to.
you've got a willing taker of your record collection.
You have to get in line.
I'm glad to hear the question, and I'm not so glad to give the answer. If you've seen the cover of the book about me and what my office looks like, it's very hard to find a lot of things, and I'm not aware of where all of those records are. If I have time before I depart this planet, I may try to put them together and maybe give them to the Jazz Foundation. I think I'd give them to the Jazz Foundation of America to see if they have any use for them. That's the organization that makes sure that jazz musicians stay alive in terms of having a place to eat and sleep. And maybe they could make some use of that as an ancillary benefit.
They do terrific work.
How many records do you think you have?
I can't begin to count. They must be in the tens of thousands.
Here?
But again, if you look at the cover of the book, you'll see that I work in a situation where it's even hard to find myself some days.
Let's see. Our next caller must come from the very East Village. Rachel calling from France?
Yep.
Hi, Rachel. Where are you in France?
Hi. I just wanted to thank Mr. Hentoff for his continuing devotion to freedom. I've been following him for a very long time, and I'm just thrilled that while he doesn't write about jazz anymore very often, he really cares enough about freedom in every way. And thank you. God bless you. May you live a long, long time.
Well, thank you so much. I do write about jazz now, but I no longer write about it for the Wall Street Journal. After many years, I got fired there. I was too independent, I guess. But the last piece I did for them, I'm so glad I had a chance to do it. It's about a 24-year-old pianist and composer, Joey Altman, who is really the personification of the past of jazz. He's really deep into that, the present of jazz. He has his own voice, and that leads him into the future of jazz. And he's so important in terms of the family of jazz. Whenever he has a record date, he tries to get as a sideman the tenor saxophonist Houston Person, whom I've also written about for the Journal. He's in his late 70s. He knows not only how to swing, but he's one of the most lyrical jazz players ever. So here you have the 24-year-old and the 70s guys, and they make recordings that, to use a phrase that Duke Ellington rarely had a chance to use, they're beyond category because they're timeless.
How do you think you have made the biggest difference with your pen and your typewriter in your lifetime?
Oh, that's a question I don't think I'm capable of answering. It's hard to know what effect you have. Probably the only effect I have from people who have followed me and then find out that I've written something totally opposed to something they take to be very important, if they decide immediately, well, to hell with this guy, but then they begin to think about it, if maybe I've helped people think for a little while about some of their favorite beliefs and argue with me, and then maybe come to a different conclusion, because that's how I always changed. I would read something or hear something, and I'd stop and say, wait a minute, maybe I'm wrong.
Before you and David go, you won't remember this, but you were actually instrumental in the success of this show, because when we first started, after about a month or two, you became the first journalist to praise this program in print. You did a column about an issue we were covering. I don't even remember what. But right in the lead, you wrote something on Brian Lehrer's terrific program on WNYC, the most smart, well-informed, blah, blah, blah. So we fooled you early on. And after you wrote that, a lot of other people started to pay attention. So 25 years later, thanks for the blurb.
Well, I certainly wasn't wrong. As I said to your colleague when she called me, I keep learning from the Brian Lehrer show.
And David Lewis's film about Nat Hentoff, The Pleasures of Being Out of Step, screening. Is it just today and tomorrow at the IFC in the Village?
Through tomorrow night, yep. And then we go on to L.A. and other cities and across the country.
Great. Congratulations on the film. Nat Hentoff, good to hear your voice again.
Thank you very much, Brian.
Well, thank you both. And David, thank you for keeping me alive even when I'm not here.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Nat.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.